And Radio Derb is on the air. Yes, this is your industriously genial host, John Derbyshire, with an early look at the news ahead of the Labour Day weekend. On account of the holiday, we're going to tape earlier than usual this week. There will be no short measure, though. On the contrary, because this will be your last Radio Derb broadcast for 10 days, we have tried to pack a little more into it. You're welcome. Okay, let's see what we've got. This week marks the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. I've said what I have to say about the anniversary in my posted column at Tacky's Magazine this week. What follows here is just supplementary. A thing I didn't say in my column is that I can't summon up any enthusiasm for King's speech because of a deep, lifelong and general, and I mean non-King-specific, a general distaste for gassy rhetoric. I don't think my distaste is personal to myself either. I think it's characteristically English. We're just not much moved by oratory. Orators in Britain tend to be Welsh, like David Lloyd George or Aneurin Bevan, and the English tend to dismiss them as windbags. One possible riposte to that is to say, what about Winston Churchill's famous speeches that so inspired the Brits during the dark days of World War II? Well, I have a handy counter-riposte. This is from the London Daily Mail, August 22nd. Quote, a new book by Professor Richard Toy, based partly on reports by the Mass Observation Exercise, which collected the private thoughts of the British during the war, in diaries and by direct eavesdropping, radically undermines the popular image of Churchill as a sublime popular wartime orator who held the nation together during the darkest phases of the war. Professor Toy says, quote, there is little evidence that Churchill's speeches made a decisive difference to the British people's will to fight on. End quote. So there. And in this same context, I can't resist a quote from George Orwell's 1943 riposte to the pacifist Alex Comfort. Comfort had written a long poem setting out the case for pacifism and non-resistance to Hitler. Orwell responded in kind, 15 stanzas of iambic pentameters, making the case for patriotism. Here is stanza 11. The first two lines of it quote phrases from Churchill's speeches. Quote, I'm not a fan for fighting on the beaches, and still less for the breezy uplands stuff. I seldom listen in to Churchill's speeches, but I'd far sooner hear that kind of guff than your remark a year or so ago, that if the Nazis came, you'd knuckle under and peaceably accept the status quo. Maybe you would, but I've a right to wonder which will sound better in the years to come. Blood, toil and sweat, or kiss the Nazi's bum? Ah, Orwell, there was a chap who knew how to slip the literary knife in. I listen in to Obama's speeches even less often than Orwell listened in to Churchill's, and with even less tolerance. I sure won't be listening into his Wednesday speech commemorating King's. With all his well-advertised faults, his shady associations and his leftist leanings, I'll allow King this much. He most likely believed in the religious ideas that provided the framework for his speech. I've read a million words about Obama, including the man's own autobiography, and I don't believe he has a religious bone in his body. He probably does believe in the magical explanations for black failure, in institutional racism, stereotype threat, white privilege, and all the rest of the sinister vapours and miasmas, the dark invisible forces keeping the black man down. Whether or not you believe in either religion or magic, I think you have to acknowledge that the one is more substantial than the other. Religion has sustained great civilizations and moved men to great deeds. Magic is just lazy thinking and tawdry tricks, cheap and hollow. No, I won't be listening into Obama's speech. If I want cheap and hollow, I'll go to the 99-cent store. King's speech loses some of its force for readers today because the whole business of dreaming, as employed to refer to big, expensive new government programs, has been considerably devalued. That's putting it politely. I personally am about ready to throw up in my mouth the next time I hear some moocher tell me how he's dreaming of government grants and favours. What happened to the classic American ideal of self-sufficiency within the law? Isn't anyone dreaming of that anymore? When it comes to dreaming about the wealth of productive, law-abiding Americans being taxed off and transferred to scofflaws and parasites, nobody is dreaming harder than illegal infiltrators from Mexico and points south. I'm sure listeners all know about the so-called Dream Act, which aims to give the precious boon of lawful US residence to all these shameless gatecrashers, and also to their mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, cousins, and collaterals. But hold on there, Derb, you heartless bigot, I hear you cry. Aren't these dreamers high school valedictorians who will bless our country with their talents and energy? Do you really want them to suffer because of bad choices their parents made? To the latter point, children have suffered throughout history and will continue to suffer into the far future for bad choices their parents made. There are kids with parents in jail, kids with only one parent, kids living in crappy neighbourhoods, kids being raped by live-in boyfriends because of bad choices their parents made. That's life. It's no reason to throw our national sovereignty out the window. And as to blessing our country with their presence, here are a couple of news stories at random. One. An illegal alien brutally murdered Laura Wilkerson's 18-year-old son in Texas, tied his body up and then doused him with gasoline before burning him. Wilkerson would later find out that an illegal alien, who would have been eligible for citizenship under the Dream Act, brutally murdered her son after he offered to give him a ride home. Two. An intoxicated wrong-way driver who pleaded guilty to the killing in April of a Richmond Times-Dispatch newspaper carrier had been convicted of DUI a year earlier and had never been licensed to drive in Virginia. Santos Gabriel Tomas, 30, which makes him Dream Act eligible, by the way, an immigrant from Guatemala in the country illegally, was convicted in March 2012 of driving under the influence of alcohol in neighbouring Lunenburg County. I could go on for a long time, but I urge you to seek out these stories for yourself, which you can do by going to the website of The Remembrance Project. That's theremembranceproject, all one word, .org, which lists a good selection of them. The Remembrance Project was set up in 2009 to raise awareness of Americans killed by illegal infiltrators. Reading these terrible stories will show you what a nightmare we're bringing upon ourselves with this dream foolishness. Urging us to dream is one way that interest groups and self-aggrandizing politicians can lift our eyes up to the lofty heavens so that they can pick our pockets. Another way they have of doing it is to beg us to think about the little children. The kiddies. Think of the kiddies. This kiddie ploy is also good for getting us into unnecessary wars. So here was Secretary of State John Kerry speaking ex cathedra in Washington, D.C., August 26th. Quote,
"What we saw in Syria last week should shock the conscience of the world. It defies any code of morality. Let me be clear. The indiscriminate slaughter of civilians, the killing of women and children and innocent bystanders by chemical weapons is a moral obscenity. By any standard, it is inexcusable, and despite the excuses and equivocations that some have manufactured, it is undeniable."
Well, it's not totally undeniable, Mr. Secretary. The opposition in Syria includes some very unpleasant people. People who believe, for example, that flying civilian planes into civilian office buildings is a meritorious act in furtherance of their cause. I don't doubt they would pull a false flag stunt like this if they could. As Radio Derb said last week, the evidence here implicates the government forces, but it's far from dispositive. But even if we suppose the Syrian government did it, what business is it of ours? Even before the present civil war broke out, Syria was a basket case country of no significance to us. The only US interest you could argue in this war is our general interest in killing jihadis wherever we can. Since the jihadis are all in the anti-government forces, that should line us up with the government, not the rebels. You could make a case, I wouldn't bother to argue much with you, you can make a case that we should supply covert financial and military support to Bashar Assad so he can kill more jihadis. It'd be cheaper and easier than us doing the work. Ah, what about those kiddies, though? Well, what about them? I've just been reading the September-October issue of Foreign Affairs, which has an article by Africa expert Jason Stearns on the war in the DR Congo, what used to be called Zaire. That war's been going on since the ramshackle kleptocracy of Joseph Mobutu collapsed in 1996. Nearly 20 years. And I'm sorry, but I can't mention the late president of Zaire without giving you his full name and title. Mobutu Sese Seko Kuku Mbendu Waza Banga. The honorific part there translates as "the rooster who leaves no hen untouched." Ah, there were giants in those days. So, yes, the Congo Civil War, getting on for 20 years. Number of dead, not known even to the nearest million. But a 2007 report estimated around 2 million children dead to that point. Why didn't we intervene there, if we're so exercised about dead children? I have two kids of my own, for whom I would happily take a bullet. My brother's and sister's kids are of concern to me, to a lesser degree. the kids of my neighbours and my town likewise, and those of my state and my country, American kids. Beyond that, my concern is pretty attenuated and easily outweighed by other considerations. Considerations like, for example, the wisdom of my nation going to war. We are coming up to the anniversary of World War I, when British troops marched off in a sentimental haze to assist plucky little Belgium against beastly nun-raping Germans. 4 years later, with 20 million dead and four great civilized empires in ruins, people wondered what the heck we had been thinking. Let's hope that John Kerry's and Barack Obama's tears for the little children of Syria don't lead us into a similar catastrophe. If they do, it'll be our kids who pay, not theirs. In case you thought that leftists were all through milking the Trayvon Martin case, here's a story from the Windy City Times. Just so you can orient yourself properly before we start, I'll note that the main page of the Windy City Times carries the banner, quote, "Celebrating 25 plus years of lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender news," end quote. The headline on this story, dated August 21st, reads, quote, "Event looks at Trayvon Martin case through queer feminist eyes." That's the headline. Opening paragraph, quote, "In the wake of the Trayvon Martin verdict, Chicago has seen several public events and workshops exploring its aftermath. On August 15th, queer and feminist scholars gathered at the famous Hull House for a panel titled Transformative Justice and the Trayvon Martin Case, a Consideration. If you don't know why Hull House is famous, Google Jane Addams. She was a WASP reformer in the late 19th, early 20th century, who wanted to break down class barriers and help immigrants assimilate into American society. She was also a queer feminist, avant la lettre, although naturally, the times being what they were, she didn't make a public show of it. Anyway, Hull House was one of her foundations, where middle-class women could mingle with the poor and do good works. It all sounds a bit precious and naive, but I'm bound to say, the queer feminist thing aside, I can't summon up much animosity against those old reformers. They probably did much good. At least none of them used their community activism as a stepping stone to the presidency. Okay, back to this story in the Windy City News. So, we have a panel of self-described queer feminists talking about the Trayvon Martin case. What do they have to say? Well, these are root causes people. The key phrase is transformative justice. I'll allow one of the panelists to define that for us. This panelist is Tracy Schlesinger, Associate Professor of Sociology at DePaul University, who works on racial disparities in sentencing. Quote from her. "Transformative justice is the transformation of the social conditions that perpetuate violence." End quote. See? I told you. Root causes. Professor Schlesinger went on to say that, quote, "The breakdown of elements like public schooling in cities like Chicago, coupled with more intense private and public policing of black bodies like Martin's, were indirectly and directly the cause of such events." End quote. As I recall, when police found burglary tools and stolen jewellery in Trayvon Martin's backpack, They took no action. Doesn't sound very intense to me. A different panellist, Erica R. Miners, got to the heart of the matter. Miners is a professor in the Gender and Women's Studies Department at Northeastern Illinois University. According to her, Trayvon Martin was killed in part by colonialism. Key quote. The web of interconnected histories and contexts that made it possible for George Zimmerman to shoot Trayvon Martin and walk away cannot be separated from white supremacy, colonialism, heteromasculinity, and capitalism. End quote. Professor Miners was just clearing her throat there, mind. She went on to cite the Bradley Manning trial, the bombing of Yemen, the expansion of the prison system, the high presence of police in Chicago public schools, and the, quote, targeting of trans youth. So, that's the queer feminist take on Trayvon Martin for you to discuss with your buddies down at the bowling alley. At some future date, I shall give you the straight masculinist take. Then you'll have a fully rounded picture. In last week's broadcast, we reported the killing of 88-year-old Delbert Belton in Spokane, Washington. Mr. Belton was a combat veteran of the Battle of Okinawa back in World War II. We reported that he was randomly stomped to death by two random teens in the parking lot of his pool club. We should now correct that. Mr. Belton was, in fact, not randomly stomped to death. He was randomly clubbed to death with flashlights by these two random teens. After randomly selecting Mr. Belton for their attentions, the random teens randomly attempted to rob him. Mr. Belton's wallet was found in the vicinity, and money had been taken. And who was at fault in this dreadful incident? Well, first of all, we were. You, me, and everybody else. Although I guess mostly the inhabitants of Spokane. That is, according to Spokane Police Chief Frank Straub, as reported by the Los Angeles Times, August 26th. They quote Chief Straub as follows, quote, "One of these individuals was pretty much a standout basketball player. And because nobody wrapped their arms around him, nobody cared enough about him, he's now going to face murder and robbery charges. And probably he's looking at the rest of his life being significantly affected, if not destroyed by this." End quote. Poor little chap. Doesn't your heart go out? And it's our fault for not having wrapped our arms around him. As the great Dr. Heinz Kiosk used to say, we are all guilty. Some of us are more guilty than others, though. Chief Straub singles out one person for particular blame. Delbert Belton. Quote from the chief. Quote, "Our information is that the individual fought back, and that may have made this a worse situation." End quote. I wonder if Mr. Belton, having fought back against the Imperial Japanese forces on Okinawa, made that a worse situation. What do you think, Chief Straub, over there on the West Coast? Or would you prefer the question in Japanese? One of my favourite websites, as I'm sure I've mentioned before, is Anne Corcoran's Refugee Resettlement Watch. Anne keeps a watch on the refugee resettlement racket. And boy, is it a racket. The chief racketeers here are the so-called VOLAGs, the voluntary agencies that bring refugees in once the UN has identified them. The VOLAGs are mostly church-affiliated. The US Conference of Catholic Bishops, the Lutheran Immigrant Aid Society, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, the Church World Service, and so on. These VOLAGs get money from the US government for every refugee they bring in, as much as $4,000 a head. Although how this squares with separation of church and state, I have never figured out. They all have very well-paid executive staff running their refugee operations. The original idea, when resettlement got going 30 years ago, was that the VOLAGs would help the refugees settle in American communities using funding from their own resources. In fact, after a few weeks, typically 3 to 4 months, the VOLAGs hand off refugees to the welfare agencies and go collect another batch. Yes, these refugees, the USA takes about 100,000 a year, 40% of them Muslims, and you can multiply that by about 4 for follow-on dependents and such. These refugees are instantly eligible for welfare, for TANF, Medicaid, the EBT card, public housing, supplemental security income, and a whole raft of other programs. In a report this week, Anne highlights the case of Springfield, Massachusetts, where the mayor, Dominic Sarno, has asked the federal government to stop sending refugees to his town. He is backed up by Abdullahi Ibrahim, an actual refugee. Quote from the original news story. Ibrahim said he and his wife and 5 children resettled in Springfield on Wilbraham Road last October, aided by Lutheran Social Services of New England, after fleeing from Somalia to an Ethiopian refugee camp. The family has struggled since with the new language, the colder climate, and challenges such as where to get heating fuel and how to pay for heat. There was not enough assistance from Lutheran Social Services after the initial welcome, and some funding for rent and expenses, he said. End quote. As Anne points out, Massachusetts is one of the top states in the nation for welfare generosity. Mr. Ibrahim, who looks about 60 and speaks no English, obviously isn't working. With those 5 kids, not to mention the cost of their schooling, and his SSI, probably, and all the other goodies, I'd estimate that Mr. Ibrahim is costing us around $250,000 a year. There really wasn't any way to help him in Ethiopia for less than that? He doesn't even sound very happy here. Perhaps he's not dreaming hard enough. It's bad enough that this major component of US immigration policy is all decided by the UN. It's bad enough that whenever thorough checks are done, for example, DNA testing for people claiming family relationships, there is always found to be massive fraud in the programs. It's bad enough that religious charities are getting scads of public money. It's bad enough that Washington, D.C., where the VOLAGs are headquartered and all the political movers and shakers live, takes practically no refugees, less than 40 a year. It's bad enough that Congress has never questioned the quota presented to it by the administration. That's all bad enough. Now the Obama administration is prioritizing homosexual and transsexual refugees, or pseudo-refugees. One of the VOLAGs is demanding that Medicaid pay for sex change operations for refugees. There is so much madness in America right now, it's hard to keep track. This, though, is one matter where you can get involved locally. When the mayor of your town announces that 5,000 Syrian refugees are to be settled along Main Street, tell him how you feel about it. Then get together with your neighbours and start building barricades. And now for our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. Just a brief follow-up to that last segment. I'm going to dial a number here. Actually, the number 1-888-678-8914, which is Michigan Department of Social Services hotline. I'll get a recorded message, 56 seconds long. Bear with it, please. The interesting part is at the very end. In case you don't know, the EBT card replaces the old food stamps program. Nowadays you swipe a card for your free food. Okay, here goes.
Thank you for calling Michigan EBT Customer Service. Qualified Department of Human Service clients who have been using their food assistance at approved restaurants will no longer be able to do so as of August 1, 2013. We regret any inconvenience. Cards can still be used at qualified homeless, elderly, and disabled meal provider locations. Bridge cardholders can use their cards at many farmers markets. Check online at the Michigan Farmers Market Association website for a participating market near you. Cardholders should be wary of fraudulent attempts to obtain your card number or PIN. We will never call you or send you a text message or email requesting that you contact us to prevent your EBT card from being deactivated. Please do not respond to these requests. For English, press 1. Para español, oprima 2. De la Arabia, adres 3.
Get that? The very last bit of the message there translates as press 3 for Arabic. And you still don't think we're doomed? Item. Last week on Radio Derb, we had some good clean fun with hate crime hoaxes. Well, here's another one. The afflicted institution here is St. Peter's Preparatory, a private, all-boys Roman Catholic school in Jersey City, over there in the Garden State. Any news story about a school, we of course first want to know the student demographics. St. Peter's is 63% white, 7% black, and 30% other, about equally Asian and Hispanic. Okay, so what's the story? The story is that back in May, a 16-year-old black student ran for president of the student council. He thereupon received 4 hateful text messages, calling him rude words and threatening him. The student brought these messages to the attention of school officials, who called in his father and Jersey City Police. A battalion of National Guard troops was dispatched to secure the school in lockdown, the Constitution was suspended, and the United Nations was alerted. Now, I made that up. But there was a heck of a fuss. I don't have precise details, but I imagine there were parents demanding an investigation, teachers rending their garments, weeping students begging for trauma counselling, protests, demonstrations, candlelight vigils. You know the script. Guess what? The police were able to trace the source of the text messages to the student himself. I know you are just as stunned as I am, listeners. Item, just some closing snippets. Scientists in Sweden have spotted a new element, atomic number 115. They have no name for it yet, but no doubt Obamanium is under serious consideration. A chap in Cambridgeshire, England, is gravely injured and in hospital after being trampled by a herd of cows. This follows an incident in Brazil 3 weeks ago when a man in bed with his wife was killed by a cow falling through his roof. So something's going on with cows lately. Keep your eyes open. African news. 25,000 students took an entrance exam for the University of Liberia, and not one of them passed. What, don't they have affirmative action over there? And a 15-year-old boy in Kyrgyzstan has died from bubonic plague, a.k.a. the Black Death. I hope and trust our good friend, President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov, in nearby Turkmenistan, has alerted his well-equipped and efficient public health services. If anyone can forestall a worldwide plague, it is our dear friend, President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov. That's it, ladies and gents. From all of us here at Radio Derb and Tacky's Magazine, a very restful and relaxing Labor Day weekend. May you return to your customary labours on Tuesday, brimful of energy and enthusiasm, as we shall be, in order to bring you more from Radio Derb next week.